Birth, the Grand Division, Chapter 15. "Welcome back, son," said Abdullah as he stood from his large leather chair behind an oversized desk. His penthouse office was his favorite place to be. Here he was connected to the world's raw news flow, with thousands of reports each hour flowing from journalists, photographers, and spies all over the world. Some would, and should, never see the light of day. Owning the LA Times was more like being a starship captain than being a journalist. Every hour he would make decisions based upon a prime directive not to keep the world asleep like other news organizations. Instead, his inner drive was to awaken the world to the truth around them. Caution had to be applied, or else the world would collapse in panic, especially if they suddenly realized they were sleepwalking their entire lives. He often told his staff that the entire world is staggering along each day asleep, but there are a few of us who are awake, and we live in a constant state of amazement. "Hey, Dad, it's so good to be back. You have no idea," said Orfan as he embraced his father. It was perhaps the last time in his life he would be able to safely travel to Iran and see his brother, who had been sent to live with his father's brother when he was 17. He remembered that night like a dream. His mother was crying and pleading for his brother to stop yelling at his father. His father saw the worst of the government seizure of all the oil assets in the name of the state. He escaped with his money and his life, but not after two serious attempts on his life. The fatwa issued against him is eternal, but most of the assassins have either died or forgotten about the price on his father's head. By the end of that night, his brother was on a plane to Iran to live with his brother. Orfan was different. He was agile and strong like his father. He was patient and cunning like his mother. He got excellent grades in school, and when he was only 16, his father arranged for him to work on offshore oil rigs. There was no escape, really. The money was excellent, the work was hard and dirty and honest, and that was why his father had sent him. The first tour was hell off the coast of Alaska. It was cold, and the waves unceasingly lashed the bottom of the floating rig. The second was off the coast of Virginia, and the shore time made up for the rig duty by far. The final tour was aboard the finest drill rig in the world, the Deepwater Horizon off the Gulf Coast. 11 men died and 36 were injured when it was swamped by the giant waves induced by the beginning movements of the Union of the Polarity coming apart. He was the only living witness to that event. Since that time, he had been chased, shot at, flown into space, and in hiding from an immeasurable army of darkness that made his father's days in Iran look like a street protest. There was a reason he was standing on that tower to see those waves come through. There was a purpose to this place and this time, and he knew he had a major part in it. But there was a big part of him that wanted to run into the crowd and join his friends. He wanted to ride his Harley and go surfing and drink too much and meet beautiful women. But tonight, he was back in his father's arms, and he felt the joy of purpose and honor. He knew his friends would never have this love for him. He also knew they would likely not survive the coming days. "Let me start with some dark news," said Abdullah, releasing his son from his iron embrace and motioning for him to take a seat. He turned to open the glass humidor and picked a cigar from the lower shelf. He placed the end of it into his battery-powered cigar cutter, and the end was perfectly trimmed without ripping the outer wrapper. He turned to his desk and picked up his brass lamp lighter and pressed the thumb switch. The dual blue torches sizzled like tiny jet motors as the end of the cigar cast a warm red glow upon his Persian face. He blew the smoke out through a ring he could so perfectly puff, and then turned to his son while he walked with his back to the 30-foot window overlooking the Los Angeles Basin nightlights. "There has been a serious attempt on Shelley's life," began Abdullah. "Is she?" asked Orphan. She is through surgery and is expected to recover nicely, but she will be at Los Robles Hospital for a few days. They want her dead because of the assignment I gave her. She is working for Channel 5 News, but she's using that platform to get this information out to the world. Someone very high up does not want that information out there, so they tried to kill the mouthpiece. He paused for a moment and took a few puffs of his cigar. I only trust 3 men in this world, and 2 of them are in D.C. I want you to go to the hospital and keep watch over Shelley. Yes, sir. But how can I, he started to say, this is about presence more than anything else. But don't trust anyone you don't know. Got it? Prodded Abdullah. Yeah, I got it. But I don't know. I mean, what if there is trouble? Asked Orphan. You remember the games we used to play when you were young, you and your brother? Yeah, sure I remember. I hated them, for the record. The oil business is full of scorpions, but men stand in line to work there, he said. I taught you to lead the enemy with your sights so you can strike while he is on the run. I taught you what thirst feels like and what it means to be invisible like the desert wolf spider. You won't make it into the hospital with a gun, but take this ceramic knife, he said, opening the side drawer in his desk. This will go through the detector and is sharp enough to cut atoms in two, he said with a tough smile for his son. She is like the princess of truth for me. Do you understand? Said Abdullah. Yes, father. I rode my bike over here. I didn't know, said Orphan, looking down at the floor. Take the Raptor, he said, tossing him the key fob. You will one day control this empire. You might as well begin playing with the toys, said Abdullah. Orphan offered a reserved smile. His father had taught him the devil attacks hardest when we celebrate a blessing too much. Wealth is a tool for the powerful and a millstone for the weak, he would say. He walked up to his father and stood before him. He wanted to bow or something, but he simply extended his right hand to him. His father placed his palm against his, and they gripped for the first time. They were now the same height, and had the same Persian smile and the same onyx eyes that could not lie. The handshake was just long enough. Orphan turned and walked to the elevators with his back to his father. It was the ultimate sign of trust. He recalled playing on this elevator when he was a boy. It was so much fun to jump up when the elevator dropped away from the penthouse. He laughed through his calm breath with the memory of wondering why he didn't just stay in the air all the way to the bottom. He had learned many things about the reality of life, mortality, his father would call it. Don't trifle with mortals, he used told him one time after being reported for fighting at school. They don't understand anything but death and dying, he said many times. Send to heaven first whoever seeks to end your life's purpose, was one of his stern axioms of life. Spending nearly his entire youth in jiu-jitsu and taekwondo taught him how to fight. The rest of the time was learning from his father how not to fight, but to think one's way through a conflict. Quickness over size was the main lesson. One perfect strike is better than 1,000 in the air, his sensei would tell him. He recalled bruises and tapping out, and so many times he wanted to quit. Pain is the best teacher, was posted on the wall of the studio. He was right. The idea was to make the other guy feel pain, so you don't have to. The Raptor was Ford's coolest truck, with a dual turbocharged V8 and full-time four-wheel drive. Here in the valley, there was not much need for the off-road nastiness of this mostly aluminum truck, but the black-on-black truck with street radials was nothing short of dominating. His father had quarter-inch steel plates added to the driver and passenger doors, and dual-layered Lexan windows to make the truck bulletproof to most rounds. Remember what I am saying, he would start when he was ready to teach something he thought was profound. The doors will keep trouble out, And the gas pedal will get you out of trouble, he said one day when they were getting on the freeway after martial arts training. This truck was like a wide receiver with halfback attitude. The engine growled to life with the press of a button. The dual-pin door locks latched as soon as the truck started rolling toward the GPS coordinates he put into the system. It would take nearly an hour to get there from here at this time of night, so he pressed the entertainment screen and found his favorite Sirius XM channel and added the 500-watt power to the man cave that was the interior of his father's Raptor. Sometimes, being a Bayazed had its benefits. He slipped the short ceramic blade into a thin sideways pocket over his heart and a thin leather vest. The black handle stuck out slightly, but the Velcro held it in place nicely. The truck surged through the 10-speed transmission and the turbos whined as he pulled onto the freeway. He liked cars, but the vantage point of a truck somehow gave a superior feel to the freeway. Besides, for some reason, girls liked the truck better. He focused on Shelley for the rest of the trip and the priceless charge his father had given him. She was his golden girl, with the voice, the beauty, and the balls to say what was on her mind. He laughed to himself, remembering that interview of the drunk mayor at the Santa Anita racetrack. It was like the ultimate drunk uncle routine, and Shelley got fired over it. It was then that his father had taken her under his wing. She was almost killed when her Channel 5 news helicopter nearly collided with the jet he was in. She was a good reporter. She was doing great work, slowly and carefully awakening the people to the coming cataclysm and the reason why each of them may be alive on the earth right now. In his nearly 20 years in this world, he had already seen more than most, and he was very aware of a great sense of purpose instilled in him by his father. It was something his brother never saw coming. He had no respect for his effect on the future. Counterpunching was fine for the ring if you're willing to take a punch first, but it's no way to live life. He slowly weaved in and out of traffic. It was a crime to drive this truck the speed limit. Besides, police never patrolled the freeways anymore. It was all done by camera. Once they made the license plate of this truck, they would cancel out any concern. After all, it was the LA Times. He took the off-ramp to the 101, and traffic lightened up a little. Man, he said to himself, where in the hell are all these people going? He asked, looking at the bumper-to-bumper mess on the southbound side. Within 30 minutes, he changed lanes to the right to exit for the Los Robles Hospital. It was a top-notch trauma center for this area and had a great reputation for saving lives. He remembered reading articles in the local Harley magazine about guys having their brains stuffed back into their skulls after going down with no helmet, and then living to ride again. He always wore a helmet after getting hit with an 80-mile-an-hour bee in the cheek. If a damn bee can feel that bad, imagine what the asphalt can do, he told the sales girl at the Harley store. Shortly after buying the upgraded DOT helmet, he got hit in the head by a blackbird on the freeway. It would have killed him without a helmet. He pulled into the hospital parking area and got close to the visitor's entrance to park. He grabbed his phone and texted his father that he had arrived safely. The truck chirped deeply like a badass robot squatting in the dark to await the next command as he pocketed the key fob and walked toward the door. He looked around and shifted his weight to the balls of his feet. He stretched his arms behind him to stretch out the nearly one-hour drive. The information counter was staffed with a gorgeous young girl who looked Persian. He took a chance. "How are you this evening?" he asked in Farsi with the smile of an older man. "God be willing, I am in good health," she said in a smooth dialect. Perhaps she was Moroccan. They had a smooth way of speaking. Even their death curses were sexy and lurid-sounding, even if they sometimes talked of warming their feet with a fire made from the bones of your children. "I would like to visit the room of Shelley LaSalle," he said again in the royal tone he was taught by his father. It was disarming, and yet elicited caution in the listener, like a dog that would wag its tail and gladly bite your hand as you bent down to pet it. "She's on the fifth floor in room 578. Take those elevators and turn right out of the doors and then right again at the end of the hall. The hours will end in 20 minutes, she cautioned. Thank you, he said, and broke her stunning gaze. He walked to the elevators, making sure her beauty did not blind him to the other people in the lobby. He watched every move and every hand. The elevator was empty, so he took it to the fifth floor and turned right, walking down the hallway to Shelley's room. He hoped it was private, as it looked like there were two beds in each room where the door was open. He arrived and opened the door to find her in a private room. She probably had good insurance as a news anchor, he thought to himself. He found the fat chair under the TV that was turned off and took a seat. He took out his phone and began searching the news and texting his dad. Shelley was sleeping soundly without a tube down her throat or anything, and the monitors seemed to be beeping happily. Only a few minutes had passed, and he heard the door handle rattle. Within a split second, he was on his feet when Bette, Loretta, and Agent Smith walked in. He relaxed and walked forward to greet them. "Hey, how are you guys?" As he hugged Bette and Loretta, he shook Smith's right hand. "We're okay. We just thought we'd stop in and see Shelley," said Loretta, speaking for everyone. "How long have you been here?" asked Smith. "My dad sent me down, about half an hour or so, just to be safe, you know," he said. "Good man," said Smith. He knew Orphan was a survivor and seemed to be in the right place at the right time when danger showed its face. He wondered if he'd make a good agent someday. "Are you staying the night here?" asked Bette. "Whatever it takes," he said. "My dad wants her to be safe." "So do we," said Loretta. "If you need anything, you let us know right away. You have my number?" "No, I don't think so," he said, looking at his screen to search his contacts. "I'll send it to you. What's your number?" The two of them looked at their screens and exchanged information while Agent Smith walked up to the bed where Shelley remained sleeping peacefully. He put his right hand on hers and leaned in to hear her breathing. "You get better, Shelley," he whispered, and he squeezed her hand. In that instant, he looked at Bette with wide-open eyes. Agent Smith was far away from the battlefield right now. Shelley had squeezed his hand in return. "Bette, come here," he said quietly. "Take her hand." Bette took up her hand and lifted her hand into the two of hers, holding it close to her face. "My God, she's in there," said Bette on the verge of tears. "She's going to be okay." Loretta and Orphan completed their exchange and smiled from the foot of the bed. The floor nurse appeared at the door. "Okay, visiting hours are over. Sorry," she said in a pleasant voice and opening the door. "Okay, guys, I'll see you later," said Orphan. "No worries, Orphan. You take care of her. And call us if anything happens or she wakes up," said Bette. "Come on, Mike. We have some dinner waiting at home." With that, the two of them joined hands and walked out of the room. "See you later," said Loretta as she walked out with them. "You're staying the night?" asked the nurse. "Yes, ma'am." The nurse looked at the note attached to the front of the chart. "There's not supposed to be anyone here with her." "Oh, wait, are you Orphan?" "Yes, ma'am. I am he." "Do you have some ID?" she asked. "Yeah, sure," he said, taking his wallet out and showing her his license. "Okay. There are some blankets in the drawer here and a pillow in the closet. That chair does recline a little," she said, smiling at him. His dark eyes and light brown skin smiled back at her and thanked her for understanding. He reached for the remote and turned on the TV at a low volume, got out the blanket, kicked off his shoes to settle in for a night of poor sleep. Shelley LaSalle would be in safe hands tonight. He took out his phone and took a quick picture of Shelley and sent it to his dad. "Sleeping well," he texted. "Be alert and prepared," he texted back. His dad used to call swimming lessons the drowning merit badge. It was his idea of making you tough enough to survive when things went poorly. "Everyone can survive cake and ice cream," he would say. "What do you want, shallow water?" But he had no regrets about his childhood. His father considered it training camp for great leadership. He told him, "Do you know where they find men of integrity? They come from boys of integrity. Now be one." Sitting there in the chair with only the barely audible sound of the old movie and the regular beeping of the monitors hooked to Shelley, he let his thoughts drift back to the early years with his father and mother. The first time his brother took his new bicycle and rode it, he was furious and started crying. He ran to his father, first screaming, "He took my bike! Make him give it back!" To which his father replied, "What's wrong? Are you hurt? Is there a bone sticking out?" "No," he screamed, stomping his foot on the ground. "Oh my gosh," he would say, "the way you were crying, I thought for sure you'd broken something." In a few minutes, his brother would give up the bike. He smiled at the anger he felt at the time and the sweet memory it provided to him now. He had many friends who complained all the time about how terrible their childhoods were, like it would purge some Freudian baggage. He had no concept of that. "My childhood was the best anyone could hope for. I don't know what you guys are talking about," he would tell his friends. And it was. The chair would do for this night. He was doing what his father asked of him, and that was enough of its own reward for him.